Blog Talk Radio.
Start it.
Johnny on the track.
Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we're here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team.
Yes, yes, yes. What is going on, everybody? Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Inside the Octagon. I'm your host, Kalani Lua, along with my co-host, Leo Showers. Leo, what's going on, brother?
What's up, dude? Good to hear from you.
Hey, good to hear from you, too, man. Glad that we could get back on the airwaves and talk some sports. This episode of Inside the Octagon is brought to you by the Sports Grid Podcast, which you guys can tune into right here on blogtalkradio.com. Every Thursday between 6 and 8 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, that is the Sports Crib. Leo, this past weekend, UFC 216 went down, and actually some pretty damn good fights. Maybe not a classic card to say the least, but we did see history being made with Demetrius Johnson setting the all-time record for most title defenses. We also got ourselves a new interim champion at 155, so let's just dive right into it. First, let's start with the co-main event because I feel, you know, that was a bit more significant. Demetrius Johnson defeating Ray Borg, fifth-round armbar, one of the greatest armbar submissions of all time. Even Joe Rogan said he doesn't see that in jiu-jitsu tournaments. What did you make of Demetrius Johnson's performance against Ray Borg?
First of all, I'm glad we're starting with Demetrius Johnson, and I'm glad we're giving this guy his due because, you know, throughout this, especially in the past year, we haven't seen the UFC really give him much respect, and the fans haven't really been recognizing the greatest of all time. And I think Demetrius Johnson did a fantastic job this past Saturday. He went in there and made a big statement. He dominated the entirety of the fight. I mean, it was some significant 100 strike difference between him and Ray Borg. And then the way he just goes in there and finishes it, I think he's calling it the Mighty Whiz Bar. Just an incredible German WWE style German suplex, and in midair transitions into an armbar. Just one of the greatest finishes I've ever seen in MMA history, and well deserved for Demetrius Johnson. He absolutely went in there and delivered, and made history for himself in the UFC.
No, certainly, and wanted to start with him just because of the significance of his victory, given the fact that, like you say, he doesn't necessarily get the media hype, but he has now made 11 straight title defenses, the most of all time in mixed martial arts, breaking his tie with Anderson Silva at 10, obviously, George St. Pierre at 9, John Jones at 8. But Demetrius Johnson, his run as a flyweight in the UFC has been nothing short of dominance and just pure genius. And the way that he's been able to finish guys, it's truly remarkable. Yes, there have been some fights that went to decision, or even if he got the finish, it was a big lackluster until the finish came. But his dominance is something truly, truly to be admired and praised, and especially given the armbar submission. For folks that don't realize, he takes the back of Ray Borg against the cage, picks him up, does a belly-to-back side suplex almost. But as Borg is coming down, Johnson lets go of the waist, grabs the arm, and in midair transitions to the arm bar. So right when they land, he's already pulling on the arm, giving Ray Borg no time to try to maneuver or defend it, and give Ray Borg credit. While it was on the ground, he did try his best to scrum out of it, to kind of move around and to try to avoid tapping, but the end was obviously going to come sooner rather than later, and Demetrius got the tap out. And for Mighty Mouth NC, now he's calling it what's the nickname he's calling it?
I believe he's going with the Mighty Whiz Bar.
See, and I'm in agreement with Max Holloway. He should call it the Mouse Trap. So it was truly something remarkable. And like I said, Joe Rogan, who is one of the big jiu-jitsu enthusiasts, along with Eddie Bravo, he's even said he's never seen that done in jiu-jitsu tournaments. So that just goes to show you just how special this really was. Now, I want to ask you this, Leo, that we could discuss real quick. He's got the record for all-time wins. Obviously, he's almost looked like there's been no equal in his division. Has this cemented his legacy as the GOAT, or are you still kind of holding out on giving him that crown just yet?
No, I think there's really no other way to go in terms of the pound-for-pound rankings. I'm hearing a bit of an echo here. But yeah, I think Demetrius Johnson is certainly the number one fighter of all time. I think, you know, surpassing Anderson Silva in terms of title defenses, I think that definitely cements his legacy as the number one pound-for-pound fighter. And the way that he's doing it, I mean, he's running through people left and right. And I think Dana White made a very interesting point this past weekend that, you know, early on in Anderson Silva's title reign, I think people recognized that Anderson Silva was a very good fighter. He's one of the greatest ever. But he really wasn't clicking with fans either up until he did something amazing and he front-kicked Vitor Belfort, and then his stardom just kind of exploded. And I think we saw a little bit of that from Demetrius Johnson this past weekend. We saw something incredible, something that we've never seen in the UFC before. And I think fans are starting to recognize, maybe a little bit late at this point, but they're starting to recognize that Demetrius Johnson is one of the greatest talents we've ever seen in the cage. And I think better late than never, hopefully, moving forward, the UFC is going to start promoting him a little bit more, placing him in main event slots. You know, maybe he's not the biggest draw in terms of pay-per-view sales, but I think there's no denying at this point that the UFC in Demetrius Johnson, they have the greatest fighter of all time.
Certainly, we always say, well, what makes a superstar? What makes somebody click with the fans? And sometimes it's personality, it's look, it's charisma, it's your fighting style. It's something that clicks, and some have the entire package. Some have one or two. It's very tough. For Demetrius Johnson, you always wondered, why aren't fans just buying into him? We've talked about it here on the show. Is it because of his size? Just being such a small guy, it's really hard to, like, get excited for someone that looks like, no offense, that looks like one of your kids, you know, minus the beard. But, you know, he's 125 pounds. You know, that's your 12-year-old right there for some people at least. So I wondered if it was that. But, yeah, I also thought – and Leo, me and you have talked about this before when we watched the fights. Sometimes just because you get a finish doesn't mean it was an exciting fight. I always point to the Rashad Evans, Chuck Liddell knockout. It was one of the greatest knockouts of all time. But up until that knockout, the fight itself was boring. So if you go back and watch it, you're watching a fight where you're just like, this is kind of, same thing with Demetrius Johnson. I think a lot of times he had fights that even though he got the finish, his dominance was so good, but he didn't go necessarily for the kill. It was kind of hard to enjoy it up until the finish. He had one fight. The name slipped me right now, but he submits a guy in the last round with 1 second left. Up until that, though, you're kind of just like, oh, boy, here we go. All right, come on, where is it at? So I do wonder if this fantastic armbar finish is going to be what gets Demetrius Johnson over the top. Leo, let me ask you this then. If you're the UFC and you're starting to feel that way, do you maybe make him a headline of a pay-per-view then? Sure, maybe put another title fight as a co-main event. But do you trust him enough to make him the headline of another pay-per-view? Or give him another co-main event slot, see how the attendance and the pay-per-view buys go, see what the crowd reaction is before you put him back in the main event slot. What would you do?
I think, especially after the last year, the back and forth that's been going on between Johnson and the UFC, I think the least the UFC could do is just kind of, you know, put him up there and headline him and just push him, you know, give him that promotional push that he's been wanting. And, for Demetrius Johnson, who just broke the record, the UFC all-time record for title defenses, he wasn't even the highest paid fighter on the card this past weekend. That honor went to Tony Ferguson, who's very deserving as well. But I think the UFC can certainly do a little bit more to show Demetrius Johnson that he is, you know, a very big asset for them. I think at this point, fans are going to be a little bit more interested in Demetrius Johnson and see what he's going to be doing next. You know, how many title defenses can he really rack up before, you know, can he even make it to retirement as champion? You know, at this point, there's really nobody out there in the 125 division that can really hold a claim to say that they have the skills to beat Demetrius Johnson. So, you know, I'm thinking at this point that Johnson's just going to keep racking title defenses up until he doesn't want to anymore. He just calls it quits as the only ever UFC flyweight champion. So I think at this point, yes, you put Demetrius Johnson in the main event slot, and you do want to make a strong card around him just to cover your bases a little bit, because he hasn't really proven to be the biggest pay-per-view selling star in the UFC. So you do want to make a bit of a strong card around him. But at this point, I think he has proven himself more than enough to be capable of headlining a card. and hopefully the UFC can give him that promotional push that he so badly needs.
It is going to be interesting to see what the next move is, not just for his next fight, but even the fights following that, because like I said, maybe they want to not jump into the deep end of the pool with him just yet. But I think you make a lot of great points there in that they probably still, even if they make him the main event or co-main event, unless the main event is spectacular, really make that card something to watch just so that the numbers can match your expectations of what he should be in there doing. And honestly, I think with Demetrius Johnson, it's a matter of, okay, what do you really want to do? Most likely, he's going to want to defend the title at 125 a few more times, put the record so far out of reach that it's going to be a long time before somebody else gets to that number. We've seen throughout the UFC, there's only been three former champions, Anderson Silva, George St. Pierre, and John Jones, where we looked at them fighting and said, I don't know if anyone's going to be able to beat these guys. Now, granted, Silva is the only one of those three that did technically lose his title via a fight, GSP retiring, and John Jones with his legal issues. And look, I don't care what you say, Leo, that whole day, that Chris Weidman fight was a fluke, but I digress. It happened. Demetrius Johnson might try to go for 13, 14, 15 title defenses. Next opponent could be the winner of Henry Cejudo versus Sergio Pettis, which takes place later on this month. I would love to see a rematch of him and Cejudo, who's improved his striking. I would also love to see Sergio Pettis get a crack. Leo, I ask you this before we move on to the main event. If you're Demetrius Johnson, or at least in his camp, how many title defenses are you looking at before you do decide to make the inevitable move to 135 for a super fight?
Well, I think Demetrius Johnson has mentioned the number 20 a couple of times, in recent months. So I think really he is going for that, 20 straight title defenses, which sounds absolutely incredible. It sounds, really just unbelievable. But if anybody can do it, I mean, who other than Demetrius Johnson can do it? And, unfortunately, at this point, I think Demetrius Johnson is just going to have to keep recycling some opponents that he's already faced. Like, you mentioned Henry Cejudo, and I think that is a very intriguing fight. A rematch at this point, because like you said, Henry Cejudo has really developed his striking a lot, and he looked incredible in his last fight. So I think that would make a lot of sense for Demetrius Johnson's next fight, unless Sergio Pettis has something to say about that. But there's always Joseph Benavidez is always lingering out there. Like we said, Sergio Pettis is kind of climbing his way up the ranks, but there's really not much else in the UFC flyweight division. I mean, so at this point, I think Demetrius Johnson is just going to have to keep recycling opponents for title defenses. But hopefully, some of these younger guys are going to start climbing the ranks and then hopefully give Demetrius a bit of a challenge later on in line. But I think if Demetrius Johnson says that he wants to go for 20 straight title fights, then more power to him. I think he wants to make that record unreachable at some point.
It is something to see just how long he wants to be there. And, 20 title defenses does sound crazy, but then you realize, he's got 11, and he really hasn't looked like, outside of the Tim Elliott fight, really hasn't looked like he's had any competition to really challenge him. Again, can always get caught with the arm bar, ankle lock, or get caught in the chin. But up until now, doesn't seem like that's going to happen. And with DJ, he does, he's not in these wars, doesn't take a lot of punishment, and he's so well-versed in everything he can do. I mean, seriously, if DJ had an extra 50 pounds on him, I think no doubt we call him the greatest fighter of all time, just because if you look at his overall skill set, he's able to strike, his foot movement, the way he commands the cage, he can counterpunch, he can be aggressive, his wrestling, his ground game, et cetera, et cetera. He literally is one of the best fighters I've ever seen pound for pound. Regardless, it is going to be something to watch if and how long he stays at flyweight, and if he does either move up to 135, or maybe one of the 135 champions decides to cut down to 125, a la TJ Dillashaw, who's not a champion right now, but he was willing to do so. It is going to be something to watch when that takes place indeed. Now, that was one title fight on the card. The second title fight had a little bit more juice, a little more sizzle to its storyline. Tony Ferguson defeating Kevin Lee for the UFC Interim Championship at lightweight via third round triangle choke. One of my favorite submissions. Leo's caught about 75 dudes in 2 days, people. what did you make of El Kukui taking on the Motown Phenom, and what was a hype fight and pretty much delivered to an extent?
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of those UFC fights that just reminds you exactly why you're an MMA fan, because you know these are two of the top contenders in the division fighting for, you know, basically all the marbles. You know there's Conor McGregor lingering out there with the quote unquote real belt, but these guys are fighting for basically the right to call themselves champion and to challenge Conor McGregor for a title unification. And the fight really delivered. I think the hype was incredible, and then the fight itself was very entertaining, especially Kevin Lee going in there in the first round and looking really dominant, looking like he's going to start to run away with the fight. And then unfortunately, he had the weight cut issues and the staph infection that he had to deal with leading up to the fight. And he just kind of seemed to slow down a little bit towards, the second round of the fight. And by the third round, he was just, really gassing out. And Tony Ferguson, the cardio king of the lightweight division, he goes in there and handles business. And he traps Kevin Lee in an incredible triangle. He almost got an armbar early on in the round. So Tony Ferguson, his scrambling ability was incredible in this fight, and he just stayed really composed. He looked like a championship caliber fighter, and what kind of guy racks up 10 straight victories in the most stacked division in the UFC? Tony Ferguson, very deserving of the UFC lightweight interim championship. So it was an incredible fight to watch, and I was really happy for Tony Ferguson. Just the emotion that he showed after finally winning a title after racking up so many victories. So very well deserved for Tony Ferguson. I was really happy to see him get that victory.
It was a fun fight. Like I said, going into it, there was a lot of sizzle to it. There was some mutual dislike between one another, not necessarily on a personal level like we've seen in the past, but certainly from a competitive standpoint, these guys were going at it. And Ferguson, like you said, really showed you that there is different levels to this competition. And as you greatly pointed out, to get 10 wins in one of the most stacked divisions in the history of MMA at 155, even BJ Penn didn't get that many, and he's considered the greatest flyweight of all time. So, but without taking anything away from Ferguson, let's not act like he went through 10 killers. Okay. It's like two or three guys on that list, and it is what it is from there. But he beat the guys that were in front of him, and of those 10 victories, only three of them went to decision. So 70% finish rate in those 10 fights. Got to give Kukui all the credit in the world. What I found interesting was we saw Kevin Lee, and we'll get to his situation in a moment here, but we saw Kevin Lee early, bouncing around, coming forward. And you kind of saw El Kukui, he got hit a few times. Okay. But then you just started to see coming forward, applying the pressure, constantly coming at you, i.e. the boogeyman, what you going to do? And it started to wear on Kevin Lee. Again, we'll get to his situation in a minute as well. But just like with the Mayweather-Connor fight, just like with other fights that we've seen before, there is something about a fighter constantly putting pressure on you, constantly coming forward, no matter what you do, they won't stop. That really sets a fighter off. It sucks them off their gas tank, and it kind of gets them unhinged in a bit. Tony Ferguson coming forward, it was something that I was just like, wow, this dude will literally walk through a brick wall, hellfire and brimstone to get the victory. I was very impressed with what he was able to do there. Now, obviously, in talking about this, we got to bring up Kevin Lee's situation real quick. Kevin Lee had a very tough weight cut. Apparently, it was due to a staph infection that Joe Rogan pointed out right when Kevin Lee was taking off his shirt outside the cage. It was on his left pec, and he said, "Is that staph infection?" And Leo, how does this even happen? I mean, granted, maybe you don't want to cut the fight the week of, it's the main event, but you're letting a fighter with staph infection on their chest fight? What's going on here with the commission?
Yeah, absolutely. I can't believe the commission actually let this go on. And, we saw Kevin Lee miss weight by 1 pound on the day of the weigh-ins. And then pending a doctor's decision, they would allow him, an extra time to cut the extra pound. So that means that a doctor had to evaluate Kevin Lee to see that if he was healthy enough to cut the extra pound, which, you know, he already looked really drained after the first weigh-in. So, you know, there's a question out there about, you know, why would they really let him go out there and cut the extra weight? But if you evaluate him and you don't see the staph infection that was really, you know, blatant on his chest, and you still let the fight go on anyway, I mean, to some degree, I'm glad that we got to see the fight. You know, it would have been devastating for Tony Ferguson to have another, yet another opponent drop on the day of the weigh-ins. But this it really is a black eye, both on the UFC and on the Nevada State Athletic Commission for letting, you know, a fighter go in there with a staph infection. I just don't see how they possibly could have let Kevin Lee go in there and compete. But I think we saw on the day of the fight that it really did affect Kevin Lee. I think he really looked gassed towards the end of the fight. You know, even in between the second and third rounds, he already looked like a very diminished Kevin Lee. And to be a diminished fighter against the Tony Ferguson, who's, like I said, you know, one of the best cardios in the UFC lightweight division, and this is a guy that just gets better and better as the fight goes on. Like, Kevin Lee was just walking in there, just, you know, facing absolute, you know, certain defeat. So I think the commission can certainly look at these mistakes that they made this past weekend and hopefully fix them and, you know, try to prevent these types of things from happening in the future.
Now, certainly, and that's why I didn't want to dive into it when I was breaking down Tony Ferguson's game plan, because the staph infection played a major part in not only Kevin Lee's weight cut when he missed weight initially, but then also his cardio within the fight. Even though Tony Ferguson's pressure was there, I do wonder, with Kevin Lee, how would it have been had he not had a staph infection and been fully healthy going into that fight? Would we have saw different? Because you're right, he was jumping around early, light on his feet. I was thinking initially when he came down to the cage, because he kind of did like a jog, run, hop, skip to the cage, and then was in there walking around, loud, yelling. I was thinking to myself, you're on the biggest stage of your young career so far. You're taking on your toughest competition in your career so far. Maybe you don't want to have that adrenaline dump so early. That's what I was thinking, is that maybe he's so amped up and fired up, is that halfway through the first or the second round, he's going to have that adrenaline dump. But sure enough, the staph infection played a major key in it. With the Nevada State Athletic Commission, you know, we've seen, you know, the towel gate with D.C., now the staph infection. It's something that I say, how do you miss the staph infection on his pectoral muscle? It's not like this was on his back where, you know, maybe he flexes a certain way and you can't tell, is that a muscle or whatever? Or it's not on his lower leg or his inner thigh. It's not somewhere where maybe you don't spend a lot of time looking. It's on his damn chest. If you're looking at him to give him instructions, Mr. Kevin Lee, you have 1 hour to make weight. This is what you got to do. You can't go here. You can't go there. Your eyes are going to wander and look at that chest and say, what the hell is that? That's a mighty big pimple. So I don't want to say cohesion. I don't want to say cahoots with the UFC and the commission. I don't want to say that, but you're right. It's the main event. It's the day before the fight. The second time Tony Ferguson might have somebody drop out of the fight on extremely short notice. Do we really want this, especially with Demetrius Johnson as the co-main event and not necessarily the most stacked card that we could have on here? I don't know. But again, and something else to play into that real quick. I was listening to an interview by Daniel Cormier, and he said that when Joe Rogan pointed out and said, is that a staph infection? He said someone in his ear, obviously from backstage or in a truck, production truck, tells him, don't say nothing. So, again, is this the UFC knowing Kevin Lee had a staph infection, but they wanted to try to do everything they can to stay away from talking about it and mentioning it? We know Joe Rogan gives zero fucks, so he's probably not going to listen if they tell him not to do it. He's probably going to be like, whatever, dude. So it kind of does raise the people's eyebrow to make you think, is something going on here? But nonetheless, Tony Ferguson gets the win, and now seems like he's next in line for Conor McGregor. Do you agree with that, or is there somebody else that you may have in mind for the notorious one?
Well, I certainly hope you know, the UFC is going to, you know, follow the game plan and just put in Kevin Lee against Conor McGregor. That's certainly the fight that I think the hardcore fans, I think that's the fight that, you know, we're really calling for. You know, the Nate Diaz fight against Conor McGregor, that's always going to be out there. You know, win, lose, or draw, you can always put Conor McGregor against Nate Diaz. But I think Tony Ferguson has more than enough to earn his title shot against Conor McGregor. And as Tony says, if Conor McGregor doesn't want to fight him, then he should just relinquish the belt. I think Conor has an obligation to defend the title. You know, he's got a responsibility to the division to defend the title. And I think he even mentioned that in a recent interview that, you know, defending the title and legitimizing the title is more important than money fights. So I really hope the UFC follows through and they make the Conor McGregor versus Tony Ferguson fight. I think that's, in my opinion, the more exciting fight. And like I said before, I want to see Conor McGregor in fresh matchups. I don't want to see Conor McGregor start recycling fighters because there's so many fights out there for him that there really is no need for Conor to be, you know, doing trilogies at this point in his career when, you know, the Nate Diaz, like I said last week, Nate is willing to sit and wait for Conor to do his thing. And he doesn't care if he sits out a year or 2 years. He just wants that fight. So why not just have, you know, Conor McGregor defend a title against Tony Ferguson? And whether Conor wins or loses, you can still make the Nate Diaz fight later on down the line. So I would really love to see Tony Ferguson against Conor McGregor. That's a very intriguing matchup. And hopefully, you know, by the end of this year or early next year, we'll be seeing that title unification match.
Leo, I've been like a roller coaster with this whole thing, or as Ron Bergen would say, I'm a glass case of emotions. I initially was like, nah, bump that. I want to see these guys fight back to back to back. Let's just keep it going until we can figure out what's what here. So somebody wins two in a row, let's go. Then I was like, no, you know what? No need to rush it. You don't want to do a Cain Velasquez, Junior Dos Santos, where you rush their matches so quickly that within two and a half years, they fought three times. It's decided who's the better one. You're not really interested in seeing a fourth one. And then I was thinking, you know what? That's the big fight. McGregor may not be around long enough to want to do it, with, especially now with the Mayweather fight. All the money that he's made, he may just say, I'm good. So you need to make that big money fight, get it out while you can. But now I'm on the side of, you know, you want to do these when the iron's hot. You want to get it when both fighters are at their peak. But we've seen in boxing and in MMA that if you take two fighters that are well-known with strong fan bases, with a legit rivalry, i.e., i.e., if you was to take Oscar De La Hoya and Shane Mosley, Floyd Mayweather, and who's not really anybody for Floyd just because he didn't rematch that many guys. Oh, Evander Holyfield, Mike Tyson, or if you took Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, or in MMA, if you took Randy Couture, Chuck Liddell and Tito, if you got two great fighters like Conor McGregor and Nate Diaz, it doesn't matter when they fight each other. They could both be on a five-fight losing streak. Fans are going to tune in because they want to see these fighters throw down. So although I see why you maybe want to do it when Conor's the champion, he's at an all-time high, you don't want to take the risk of one of the other guys upsetting him and he loses momentum, I truly believe that these two fighters will draw big numbers whenever they do fight. So, yes, I am on the side of let's let Conor McGregor fight some of the other guys first. Let's see how he does against Tony Ferguson. Is Khabib a possibility? Can he make the 155 and be there to take him on possibly in Russia? It would be something I would like to see go down that way. Now, if some fighters, you know, knocking on wood that it doesn't happen, but if guys maybe get injured or they get scheduled for other fights or upsets happen like we see in the middleweight division, then okay, I get it. But I say right now, Conor should have at least two other matches before he fights Nate Diaz once again, just so that other guys can get the opportunity and he could get other events going that way. What do you think about that? Is two enough or should it be more, less? What do you think?
Well, I think even one, but like I said, even if Conor McGregor were to lose, it wouldn't really throw away the Nate Diaz rematch because, you know, putting Nate Diaz in a lightweight title fight doesn't really make sense at this point. You know, Nate Diaz hasn't really done anything in the lightweight division as of late. You know, he's coming off a loss against Conor McGregor. Before that, he won one against Conor and he won one against Michael Johnson. So I don't know that necessarily, you know, and the one that he fought against Conor McGregor was not even at the lightweight division. So I don't know that necessarily puts Nate Diaz in a position to be claiming for title shots. So it doesn't really make sense for Nate to be fighting for the lightweight title. So even if Conor McGregor loses, he can still do the Nate Diaz trilogy, and you know, really nobody loses. I think Conor would, you know, if Conor were to lose, you know, certainly he's going to be calling for an immediate rematch. You know, we know what kind of guy he is, but there's not much to be lost if, you know, win, lose, or draw, if Conor McGregor just, you know, goes in there and fights Nate Diaz. So even if he just does one title defense, you can still do the Nate Diaz fight later on in the summer. I think I do like the idea of UFC doing, you know, that big July 4th weekend card. They're going to want to put the best possible card that they can, and I think there's no bigger fight than Nate Diaz and Conor McGregor, so that would make sense for me. And that's, you know, maybe just one fight away from Conor McGregor. I just do want to see him legitimize the title, defend it at least once, and, you know, for the UFC to be true to their word and give Tony Ferguson the fight that he earned by winning the interim title this past weekend.
That is some good stuff indeed, and we shall see if the UFC does decide to keep their word. Now we're being joined by one of our very good friends, one of the guys we always watch the fight with, Mr. David Stepanian. David, what's going on, brother?
Yeah, how are you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
Anytime, up, man. Thanks for coming on, man. David, I give you the floor here for these quick two topics before we move on. But what did you make of Demetrius Johnson's historic victory for 11 straight title defenses over Ray Borg? And then after, what did you make of the main event, Ferguson, Lee, and how that all played out and everything? What were your thoughts on the matter?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you guys knew, I was at the fight. So being there, seeing Demetrius Johnson break such a historic record, it was incredible to see. But I'm a little disappointed because it didn't get as much of a reaction. Like, there weren't a lot of people talking about this. I felt like this is such a big story. You know, Demetrius Johnson solidifies himself as perhaps the greatest fighter of this generation, and not a lot of people are talking about it. And it's a little disappointing to see because this is something that's always hindered Mighty Mouse's entire career. And I think they're estimating something like 175,000 or 200,000 buys for this pay-per-view. And it's really disappointing because it was such a great card, I felt. There were so many fun fights. And I felt like, you know, for fans, there was a lot of name power on this card too. So it was really disappointing to see not enough people give DJ the praise he deserves because it was such an amazing win. It was such an incredible performance by him. It was exactly what you expected. So I wish people knew more about it. I wish that, you know, more people were talking about it, but I thought it was a fantastic performance. I thought he did great. And I look forward to seeing more of that.
Good stuff indeed, and yeah, you know, you want to brag about being there. Kudos for you. It is interesting to know that, you know, one, we knew the ticket sales weren't that great, but then, like you said, being there live, you could kind of hear the DJ cheers and chants when it happened, but you being there live saying that, you know, it wasn't this loud, thunderous reaction like maybe you thought, you know, it's a bit unfortunate. Like me and Leo was talking about earlier, hopefully the UFC gets behind this guy, and that basically just becomes their promotion, is that you're witnessing this guy just extend history right here with each and every title defense he has in the future. David, what were your thoughts on the main event for the interim title between Ferguson, Kevin Lee, El Kikui getting the victory over the Motown Phenom, and now basically is in line to get a shot at Conor McGregor?
I thought it was a great fight. I thought it was a great performance from both Kevin Lee and Tony Ferguson. Hats off to Kevin Lee. He came out there. He did it. I mean, he had such a great performance. But Tony Ferguson, just too experienced. You know, he's arguably the best lightweight. And really that's where it came down to, is just the experiences. And also Kevin Lee had a lot of problems. He had the staph infection. He had a hard weight cut. You know, various factors went into that lightweight fight. But, yeah, Tony Ferguson, man, he might be the best lightweight out there. It's a tough, tough fight for Conor, but I thought it was a great, entertaining battle back and forth. I thought Kevin Lee had the upper hand most of the fight up until he was getting tired, but Tony Ferguson took advantage. He capitalized, and, yeah, that's how he ended up getting that triangle choke. But great fight, great performance.
It was a great fight. It was a great performance. And me and Leo was just sitting there talking about, okay, so what's next? Does the UFC go straight for putting the titles together, champion versus champion champion Ferguson McGregor. That could be a huge match. I know the UFC may want to try to get McGregor before the end of the year. McGregor's people has put out, he'll fight at the end of the year if he only has to do the weigh-in and then fight. He doesn't want to do any of the promotional stuff. He doesn't want to go on these tours. I don't know. Maybe he'll do one press conference. Maybe they can negotiate that into it. I want to ask you guys this. With demands like this and given, you know, McGregor's status and what he did in boxing, does McGregor now have more say in maybe how the promotion for his fights are going to go forward? I mean, do you think he could get away with saying, I'm only doing one commercial and I'm only doing one press conference and that's it? Then you'll see me at the weigh-ins and that's it? Or are the UFC going to say, yeah, that's nice, but that's not how we're going to roll? Leo, I'll start with you.
Well, I think, you know, even early on in Conor McGregor's career, and certainly since his two title runs have started, Conor McGregor has been talking about, this is a partnership between myself and the UFC, and I think Conor has proven time and time again that he has a lot of say in the way that he, you know, he promotes himself and the way that, that the UFC and Conor McGregor do business. So I think there is something to be said for Conor McGregor saying, you know, if you guys want me to fight by the end of the year, then, you know, I want this to be under my own terms, because he's coming off a big, you know, we saw the exhaustion that in Conor McGregor after that big world tour that he did with Floyd Mayweather. So, and you know, there's the media surrounding all of that, and you know, Conor McGregor's a new father, so there's certainly, I can certainly understand why Conor McGregor wants to take it a little bit easy. You know, if it were up to him, he would only be, you know, going there and fighting, and certainly fans are always going to tune in, but the UFC certainly wants to make, you know, the biggest event they possibly can, and they need some promotion. But I think it's fair for Conor McGregor to say, if you want me to fight by the end of the year, you know, this is only 2 months away, you know, let me do this under my own terms a little bit. You know, I'm willing to play ball, but I think you guys can cut me a little bit of slack here in terms of promotion and just kind of let me focus a little bit on the fight. So if Conor McGregor does want, if he does agree to fight by the end of the year, I wouldn't be mad if he did, like, a, you know, even press conferences through like a Skype or something like that, you know, just to let him, you know, get a little bit of rest, you know, cut a little bit of the travel out of the way and just let him focus on training. And if he wants to wait until early next year, then maybe they can turn that promotional machine on Conor McGregor and make the biggest event they possibly can. But I can certainly see Conor McGregor's point and wanting to take it a little bit easy with the promotional push.
I agree. I agree with Leo. But my thing is, so what if Conor doesn't fight at the end of the year? If he ends up fighting sometime next year, he's going to do all the press conferences. He's going to do all the promos. Is that what the stipulation is? I mean, I don't think he wants. He's a fan of doing all these promotional things to begin with. I mean, I remember the Diaz fight. He wanted to get paid for all this. He retired for like 2 days. He doesn't want to do these things, and he doesn't have to. I mean, he's Conor McGregor, but I think at the end of the day, the UFC, you look historically, they don't budge. You know, they hold firm on their stances. They don't budge for anyone. So I think Dana White saying a couple months ago that Conor McGregor deserves an ownership stake in the UFC, I think that's really telling. And I think, it'll be interesting to see how the UFC takes these demands, because are they going to cave? Are they going to say no? You know, you have to do these. These are our obligations that you have to do. It'll be interesting to see what the UFC does here. But I think I don't think that Conor fighting at the end of the year. I know he says that he'll fight at the end of the year if this happens, but I don't think, you know, fighting at the end of the year matters. I think what next time he fights, that's going to be his demands. He doesn't want to do the promos. He doesn't want to do the press conferences. You know, he just wants to go, like how Ronda Rousey did it. And they let Ronda do it last year. I don't know if you guys remember last year when Ronda fought Amanda Nunes. They let Ronda do all that. So why don't they let Conor do it as well? We'll see Conor fight Tony Ferguson, as Dana White stated, at the end of the year. But if they let Ronda do it, I think it's only fair to let Conor do it as well. I don't know if, you know, Ronda's head wasn't in it or whatever reason it was, but it'll just be interesting to see what they do, because it's the ball is in the UFC's court, and it's up to them to see how they respond.
That's a great point you bring up, David. And yeah, we do remember because we were there with you. But yeah, it
Yeah.
We just happened to be those two guys next to you that was screaming in your ear the whole time, telling you what was going on. Yeah, there is precedent set, just like in court. There's precedent set that yes, you did this with Ronda Rousey. Why not do it with Conor McGregor? He's just as big, if not a bigger star than Ronda Rousey. Why not do the same thing, even if it's just for the one-off here? And then you say, okay, you fight in December, win, lose, or draw for your next fight. Maybe we'll do a little bit more, as Leo suggested. Maybe we don't do a world tour, but maybe we do something where you just hit two, maybe three major markets, and then that's it. That could be something that they work out from there. So it will be interesting to see what Conor McGregor, the UFC, and possibly Tony Ferguson does next going forward. Nate Diaz remains in the cuts waiting. We'll see how it goes out. Let's get through this card really quick. We'll just skim through some of the marquee matchups, and then we could get into some MMA news. And an interesting tilt here. Fabricio Werdum had a last-second replacement, literally almost up to the minute, and Walt Harris stepping in for Derek Lewis. Unfortunately, Walker with back spasms, couldn't compete. Walt Harris, who was already fighting on the card, steps up to take on Fabricio Werdum. Tough task to make of it, but Werdum gets the first-round finish via armbar in a tremendous way. Folks, we have said on this show, and obviously we're not the only ones, but we said on this show, Werdum is one of the greatest grapplers, regardless of weight class, in the world, and this is just a prime example of that. Leo, what did you make of Werdum's let's not give Walt Harris too much down credit here, but what did you make of Werdum's performance against a short-notice opponent?
I mean, Fabricio Werdum went in there, and he did absolutely what everybody was expecting against the last-second opponent. You know, Walt Harris, really not, you know, the best grappler in the UFC heavyweight division. You know, he's more of a brawler type of fighter, and he just looked like a deer in headlights against Fabricio Werdum, who was just going in there and trying to finish his opponent as quick as possible, trying to take as little damage as possible. And he looked like an absolute world beater on the ground. So you know, 65 seconds was all it took for Fabricio to snatch that arm. And Walt Harris, I think he tapped a little bit too early, but when you're in there against, one of the best grapplers in the world in the heavyweight division, there's really not much Walt Harris could have done to really escape it. So maybe he was just trying to, delay the inevitable. So Fabricio Werdum, unfortunately, he doesn't get the marquee matchup that the fans were expecting, you know, from Derek Lewis. And I really do feel bad for Derek Lewis having to pull out once again. We were really happy when he came back from his short-lived retirement, but apparently his back issues are still lingering out there, and he wasn't able to compete this past Saturday. Hopefully, he'll be able to get those issues behind him, and we'll see him in the cage again soon. But Fabricio Werdum, once again, on the win column, and hopefully he'll be making a case for himself for another title shot later next year.
Yeah, there's really not much to discuss with that fight. It was only 65 seconds long, and it ended exactly how everybody expected. So there's not many takeaways. The big takeaway here is Fabricio Werdum. That fight was so short, and Fabricio Werdum took no damage at all. He's fighting in, 5 weeks now. Like, that's the only takeaway here is now, literally, 48 hours later, Fabricio Werdum already got scheduled as a replacement for Mark Hunt. You know, so I think it's more important to look forward. How is Fabricio Werdum going to do against Tibera? Because the Walt Harris fight just showed more of what we already know about Fabricio Werdum, and it showed more of, like Leo said, Walt Harris isn't the greatest grappler. He's more of a brawler. And Fabricio Werdum is one of the best grapplers in the heavyweight division, if not the best. So it's just that fight was just exact. It went exactly as you'd expect. So I think if you're Fabricio Werdum, it's a great win. You got your what was his purse? You got a huge purse. I think $400,000 or something like that.
Yeah.
So you know you take your $400,000 paycheck and you look for your next fight. You know, which is in about 5 weeks.
It was, to me, like a Mike Tyson fight. You knew what was going to happen. It was just a matter of when and how. Is it going to be the left? Is it going to be the right? Is it going to be an uppercut, a hook, straight? What's it going to be? And that's what this was. Again, Walt Harris is a very fine heavyweight, somebody who, as he improves, somebody to look out for. But on short notice, as you guys pointed out, not much of a grappler, taking on the best grappler in the division and one of the best in the world. It was a lot to ask for. And Verdum, you know, he got him down. And just for the people listening, he gets him and he takes his Walt Harris's back on the ground, goes for a rear naked choke. As they're falling backwards, as Walt Harris falls back to his back, Verdum then switches it from a rear naked choke into an armbar simultaneously, almost kind of like what we saw with Demetrius Johnson with his takedown to an armbar, and he just applies it so quick, and Walt Harris didn't last as long as Ray Borg in the armbar, but it was something to watch indeed, and we're going to get to Fabricio Verdum replacing Mark Hunt very, very shortly here and talk on that news because I really want to get your guys' perspective on that whole fallout. But I did want to talk to you guys about the fight of the night. Lando Venata and Bobby Green go to Venata. There you go. Excuse me. God love that public education. They fight to a tremendous split draw fight. Truly a fight that, you know, it's a fight where you really do see the heart of a fighter. Even if these guys aren't at the top of the division, but they are trying to climb up, it was a tremendous showing for both guys. David, what did you make of Bobby Green and Lando going at it? Even though it's a draw, everybody won in this fight, did they not?
Oh, it was an amazing fight. And when the fight ended, you know, a lot of the people in my section, we were talking to each other saying, this fight might have ended in a draw. I wouldn't be surprised if this fight ended up in a draw. And that's exactly what happened. I personally, you know, my parlay aside, but I thought Lando Venata won the fight. But it was still an excellent fight regardless, and I'm not disappointed by either of the draws on the card. So I thought it was a great performance by Lando Venata. I thought it was a great return back to the octagon after he lost earlier this year. I thought he did enough to get the decision, but obviously judges didn't think so, and that's why you don't leave it to the judges. But still, I think it's a great return for him. I think it gets him back in the mind frame of, well, I'm back here, I'm back on the big stage. I'm fighting Bobby Green, who, granted, was on a three-fight losing streak, but still, I mean, but let's talk about Bobby Green for a second. He hasn't won a fight in, what, 3 years or so? He hasn't won a fight in a while either, but I still thought he had a great performance as well against a tough opponent in Lando Venata. So I was very impressed by both of these guys, and I thought it was a hell of a fight, very entertaining, and I think regardless of the decision, the fans definitely won out in that fight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly in agreement with the draw. I think Lando Venata would have won the first round if not for the point deduction. So he scored that a 9-9. I think he dropped the second round, and then he won the third round. So I completely agree with the 28-28 score. I don't see how any judge could have scored it 29-27 for Bobby Green. I don't think that he won two of those rounds. But the fight itself was spectacular. I would not be mad if there's an immediate rematch between these two guys. Even, you know, as the result was announced, both of the guys seemed to be really happy with the results. I mean, there was really no loser in the fight. The fans certainly won out in a spectacular brawl between these two guys. I love the way Lando Venata just takes, you know, all these risks, and he's very, very creative. He's like a Tony Ferguson style of fighter. I think he does live a little bit too much on the edge. He takes a little bit too much damage for his own good. But, I mean, what a warrior. I mean, that's a guy that you just can't put away no matter how hard you try. And I'm not disappointed at all by the draw. I think we're going to see these two guys rematch, you know, sooner rather than later. And, you know, I'm always a little bit apprehensive about these rematches when there's a, you know, such a great first fight. You know, the second match really doesn't live up to the hype more often than not. But even so, I do want to see these guys face off against each other again and settle the score. So I think Lando Venata is one of the best prospects the UFC has at the moment. You know, he hasn't really racked up, you know, as many victories, but I think they really have a star in this guy. And I just hope to see him kind of start taking a little bit less damage in these fights, because that's not really a recipe for a long career. And I do want to see Lando, you know, kind of develop into a, you know, one of the top tier lightweights in the UFC. So hopefully he'll get some of those issues resolved, you know, in the next few fights. But I was very impressed with these two guys, and I can't wait to see him fight again.
Yeah, this was a very good fight, and you're right. If Lando doesn't get that point deduction, he probably walks away with this victory. The judges who gave two rounds to Bobby Green, hey, I thought L.A. Burry wasn't supposed to be judging this contest. But I digress.
Exactly.
It was a great showing. And, look, I know fans, I know we wish we could have these just bleed, slobber knocker, rock 'em, sock 'em type fights on every card. That's not the case for, as Leo pointed out, a long-term success. But it is nice to see it every now and then, especially, let's be honest, from two guys you really didn't expect it to come from. Granted, their fighting styles may lean towards that, but you just, you know, looking at the cards, you're thinking, okay, maybe the heavyweights do it, or maybe Darush and Durham do it, but maybe one of the top guys. Not necessarily one of the prelim cards, but it certainly sets the tone for the rest of the card. So kudos to them. And as David pointed out, Bobby Green hasn't won a fight since July of 2014. Now, there was a gap in there of a year where he was out due to injury, but he is on a 3-5 losing streak. He's 0-3-1 in his last four. Hopefully he's able to get back in the win column his next time out, because he is an entertaining fighter. Plus, I enjoy seeing a Triple H water spit whenever he gets a victory. So kudos there. John Moraga got a tremendous knockout over he got a tremendous knockout in the first round. Somebody who could be moving out the flyweight division in due time. So we'll see how that goes out. Now, I wanted to get to you guys, and I want to ask you both your opinions on the matter here. Mark Hunt is supposed to be was supposed to be fighting on a UFC card in very short time here. I'm pulling it up right now, but he gets pulled from the card due to the fact that in an interview that he did with the Player's Voice, he talked about how he talked about how he's already starting to feel the effects of fighting. His memory's starting to fade away. He's starting to slur his words, can't remember things that he just did, but he can remember things from years ago. That's just the life you live and pay as being a fighter. It is what it is. With that being said, and with the NFL and even professional wrestling, even with the attendance and the focus on CTE and head trauma, the UFC pulls him from the card and replaces him with Fabricio Werdum. What do you guys make of this fight? Now, this fight is going down November 19th. Werdum is going to be stepping in to take on Marcin Tybura, and it's in Sydney, Australia, so relatively close to New Zealand. So Mark Hunt would have been, you know, a fan favorite there. What do you guys make of the UFC pulling Mark Hunt from the card? Justifiable or not? David, I'll start with you.
I think Mark Hunt's rebuttal was the only reason that the UFC pulled him is because he filed a lawsuit against the UFC. I want to agree with Mark Hunt, but I also think Mark Hunt kind of shot himself in the foot with this interview. I mean, you know, we're at a time these days where it's a very sensitive subject when you talk about, you know, the concussions and long-term injuries from, you know, contact sports. So I think Mark Hunt kind of shot himself in the foot with the comments he made, but I also do believe that his lawsuit against the UFC did play a factor, and I also think it's a pretty disappointing move by the UFC because, you know, the fight was going to be in Australia, and Mark Hunt would have had a nice hometown crowd, even though he's from New Zealand nearby. But don't agree with the UFC's decision to remove him. I do believe Mark Hunt's in good fighting shape. I know he's old, but I mean, if you pull him from this fight, you know, what's the excuse when he fights a few months from now, when he fights someone else? You know, like, are you not worried about his mental health anymore? Is it okay now? Okay, enough time has passed. He remembers things now. No, because these are long-term injuries, and if you pull him from this fight now, then I feel like you should have done some sort of test with him or something that shows, that gives evidence that he needed to be pulled from this fight. Because if you just go out and say, oh, we're worried about
long-term injuries, then why don't you just pull everyone? You know, why? Because this is, it's combat sports, and this is a reality of contact sports and combat sports. This is just the reality of it. So I feel like if you pull him from this fight now, then you're really saying he shouldn't fight again. But we all know Mark Hunt is going to fight again eventually, and this, I do believe that this was sort of like the UFC's response to his lawsuit. They're pulling him out of this fight and costing him a payday. So I don't like the move by the UFC, but I also do believe Mark Hunt shot himself in the foot with those comments.
Well, I got to say, I completely agree with the notion that Mark Hunt completely messed up and he shot himself in the foot by, you know, making the statements that he did. I mean, if you're in combat sports and you're saying that you're having, you know, any kind of brain issues or memory problems or, you know, slurring of your words, that's complete recipe for, you know, for disaster waiting to happen. If, you know, if you were to get brutally knocked out and then, you know, these statements come out later after the fact, and then, you know, the UFC is, you know, they have a PR nightmare in their hands. So I don't agree that, you know, the lawsuit has really much to do with it. I think, you know, we've seen Mark Hunt fight since the lawsuit issue started, and the UFC has given him, you know, plenty of platforms for him to be interviewed and talk, you know, as freely as he pleases. And he's trashed the UFC left and right. And I don't think the UFC has really said much in return. So I don't think that it's really any kind of a retaliation. If anything, I think the UFC wants Mark Hunt to succeed. Otherwise they wouldn't put him in a card in Australia. So I think they really do want to push him. And I think they recognize that Mark Hunt has a fan following, but I think this is completely a PR move by the UFC, and I think it's the right one. Unfortunately, you know, as big of a fan as I am of Mark Hunt, this is absolutely the right move for the UFC, because like I said, if Mark Hunt suffers some brutal knockout and some kind of brain damage in the fight, and then these statements come out later after the fact, then that's going to look completely bad on the UFC's part. So, I do agree that there was something that had to be done. I think Mark Hunt said that, you know, a lot of what he said was in jest or was misquoted, or and he's done, you know, tests since he's been pulled and everything seems to be fine. But I think he basically backed the UFC into a bad corner that they really couldn't get out of. So I can't really blame the UFC on this one, because it was really Mark Hunt's doing that eventually led him to be pulled from the fight. So it was just an unfortunate situation, but I think the right one in the end. And I think we will see Mark Hunt later on down the line fighting again and with the UFC. Just unfortunate that the fight in Australia for him is not going to be happening this year.
Just for clarification for everybody, the lawsuit that both guys are referring to is the Mark Hunt suing the UFC due to his fight at UFC 200 against Brock Lesnar, who failed a drug test. And Mark Hunt's basically suing them, saying, hey, you guys put me in there with a dirty fighter, jeopardizing my safety. I deserve some extra compensation for that. And I even lost the fight, so I certainly should be given something for that, that I ended up losing to a juice head. So, and Mark Hunt claims that, hey, he's passed so far all the medical tests leading into it. And he went on his tremendous Instagram rant, talking, you know, calling Dana White, telling him just how much he loves and appreciates him, and how he can't wait to have Sunday dinner with him and go over church Bible verses with them. Those two certainly do get along greatly. I got to say, though, this is all on Mark Hunt. You are a fighter, and we wish you nothing but success and health. But at the same time, you can't go in there talking about injuries or things that might be going on with you, especially upstairs with the brain, considering everything that's going on in the world around that right now. And then expect your bosses to say, hey, this guy's going to get punched in the face in a couple weeks. Let's put him out there. No, 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 no. Because if something happens, and let's say there's negligence on the UFC's part, even if it's not like the NFL where they kind of heard about it and they were kind of shown evidence of it, but they kind of just kept it under wraps, even if it's just it slipped through the cracks, i.e. Kevin Lee's staph infection, they don't want to be held liable by fighters after their careers are over trying to sue them. And we know Mark Hunt is not afraid to go to court with the promotion. For Mark, I mean, Cain Velasquez even said when he was supposed to fight, hey, I got back surgery scheduled for after this fight. And they're like, whoa, 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 what the hell are you talking about? You got back surgery. You're not going to be fighting. So for him and any fighter, if you have – this is why fighters do not disclose injuries beforehand. We heard Donald Cerrone say if he does have injuries going into a fight, if he could get through it, he just fakes it through. You know, whenever he's being given his physical or looked at, he kind of just bites down on his lip and just, you know, holds it in so that, you know, while they're examining him. And when fighters fight, win or lose, day afterwards, they're giving us the Tito Ortiz effect. I got a broken neck, a cracked skull, you know, my spleen is ripped out my asshole. And then we're like, well, how are these guys getting through it? So for Mark Hunt, I say this is totally on him, totally his fault. And for you to say that your words are taken out of context, we weren't there for the interview, so we don't know if maybe you gave an entire answer and he only took bits and parts away from it. That can happen. But I got to say, man, poor choice of words, and really I think the UFC did the correct thing here, especially when you're given in the cage. It's all about fighter safety outside of the cage as well. And I want to ask you guys this as well. If you're Dana White, does Mark Hunt fight for you again? You're already going through one legal battle with him. Now you got this move going at it. Does he fight for you guys again? Or maybe do you have a discussion and say, what if we just buy you out, man? You don't have that many fights left in your fight contract. What if we buy you out? You can go to Bellator, 1FC, or whatever, and you can be their problem. But you're giving us too much of a headache right now for us to keep dealing with this. Would you guys keep or move on from Mark Hunt? Leo, I'll start with you.
I think a lot of it has to do also with the fact that the UFC heavyweight division is so thin that the UFC is desperate for talent at that division. I think, you know, maybe if Mark Hunt was a lightweight where there's no shortage of talent, maybe they just would wash, you know, their hands from that problem and just let him go and, you know, just kind of get rid of Mark Hunt out of their lives forever. But the fact that Mark Hunt is a heavyweight, he's a heavy-hitting heavyweight, you know, he's a highlight reel waiting to happen. And, of course, he's a fan favorite. I think fans are excited about Mark Hunt. They're willing to tune in to see him fight. So I think there's too much going for Mark Hunt for the UFC to just kind of let him go. I think they're willing to deal with the issues with Mark Hunt. You know, I think the UFC should do a little bit of a better job in trying to, you know, communicate with Mark Hunt. He said in the past before that, you know, even after the lawsuit started, there hasn't been too much communication from the UFC or USADA or Jeff Nowitzki or any of these people that, you know, that are involved in the situation. So there's certainly something that the UFC can do a little bit more to appease Mark Hunt. But at the same time, he is a ticking time bomb. You know, he's already proven that he's a litigious character. He's willing to go out there and sue the company for any grievances that he might have. So he certainly is a headache to have to deal with, but, you know, I think the UFC might want to, you know, just try to deal with this in a bit of a better way for them to just kind of resolve the issues with Mark Hunt and hopefully keep his UFC career going for as long as they possibly can squeeze money out of him, basically.
Yeah, very very well put. I think Mark Hunt is going to be 44 years old by the next time he fights. If he fights again in the UFC, which I do think he will. I mean, I guess it kind of puts the UFC in a tough spot, but yeah, you know, Mark Hunt is such a huge draw in Oceania, and he's such a huge draw among fans in general. I mean, you really don't have a choice but to keep him around as long as he wants to fight, as long as he's winning fights too. I mean, you know, he's lost here and there, but he hasn't looked terrible in a lot of fights, so he can still come out and bang with these other top heavyweights. You know, why not let him if his like brain issues are a concern? Then yeah, get it tested. And I mean, he's, like you said, he's passed all the tests. I don't think there's any problem with him fighting, but he is old. He's not getting any younger. I think his days in the UFC are numbered, but he's still a draw. He sells pay-per-views. You see his name on the co-main event or on the main card, you know, you say, oh, there's Mark Hunt fighting. And a lot of casuals know Mark Hunt. You know, you've seen him around promotional stuff and everything like that. So you keep Mark Hunt around. I think there's a lot of money to be made keeping Mark Hunt around. He's still goes out and bangs with these other top heavyweights. So why not keep him, you know? Let him fight as long as he feels comfortable doing so.
As Leo was saying, you know, there hasn't been much communication between the UFC and Mark Hunt. My response to that would be the same as the U.S. government. We do not negotiate with terrorists. So that would be my response to end that one, just from a joking side. But, yeah, and you guys both make great points. He still is a name. He still can be competitive. He just has a recent victory earlier this year over Derek Lewis. So he's certainly still one of the top heavyweights in the promotion, regardless of his age. I mean, hey, when you're a heavyweight and you got that type of knockout power, age really isn't going to be that much of a factor. But then again, I just wonder if it's going to be too much of a PR hit and just too much of a headache to go at it with a guy who, yes, has a fan base, is a very capable fighter in a division where you don't have that much talent in. But still in all, you're not the champion. You're not one of our major draws. You're not, you know, you're not one of our superstars. And you're not a former champion. So, I wonder if the UFC is going to be willing to put up with him and everything like that going forward. And then again, with a promotion like Bellator out there, you know, if Mark Hunt was to go there, maybe that would be a way for him to, one, work his way towards a title, and then, two, possibly earn more money there, given all the avenues that he'll be exposed to in that regard. Now,
well, just one more thing about that.
I think that's also
the problem for the UFC is that they don't want Mark Hunt to go out there and be a star for Bellator. And I think we've talked numerous times about how Bellator's heavyweight division, it's even thinner than the UFC heavyweight division. So, you know, Mark Hunt on Spike TV, that would be an absolute star in Bellator's hands. And I don't think the UFC can really afford to let go of Mark Hunt's contract so that he can go and be a star for the competition. So I think, you know, I've mentioned this numerous times. I think the UFC should overpay for their free agents in order to just keep them away from Bellator, if nothing else. You know, maybe they're not going to be the biggest star in the UFC, but at least they're not going to go out to Bellator and become even bigger stars than they could have been in your promotion. So, you know, if anything, just keep Mark Hunt, you know, you can't just keep him on the shelf because, you know, that would not be legal under his contract. They legally have to give him fights and keep him active. So I think the UFC should want to keep him for as long as possible, as long as Mark Hunt is still basically a name and a draw in the UFC fans' eyes. So if anything, just don't let him go to Bellator and become a star over there.
He's 44 years old. Mark Hunt's cardio and fighting style outside of knockouts doesn't necessarily lead to the greatest performances of all time. And let's be honest, Benson Henderson, Rampage Jackson, Roy McDonald, none of these guys are going to be major stars over there. Roy Nelson just went over there. They're not going to be major stars. But I get what you're saying, Leo, but he's not going to bring 1 million fans over there, and all of a sudden UFC cards are not going to have the viewing that we're used to seeing. So I do get what you're saying, but again, I just don't think he's that big enough of a star to make that much of a dent in Bellator's ratings as opposed to the UFC. But I you do make some great points. I wanted to ask you guys this question next, and this is a way – this is a fight that we kind of wanted to see, but never really knew if we would be able to see it. We almost got into it because I still got my conspiracy on that. That was supposed to be the original plans for UFC 200. But recently, George St. Pierre, who's making the comeback later this year at UFC 217 against Michael Bisbee for the middleweight championship, says that he is not interested in a Conor McGregor super fight because he doesn't fight smaller fighters. He naturally is the bigger fighter, formerly the 170-pound king. Now he's moving up to 185. What do you guys make of Conor GSP? Seems like on paper it would be the blockbuster event of all blockbuster events in MMA. But now you got one side saying not really interested in that. Do you guys believe him? And should the UFC try to push this fight somewhere in the future? David, I'll start with you.
Well, GSP already lobbied for this fight. I mean, he said he would do the Conor fight for $10 million last year when they were still negotiating, when GSP was trying to go away to Bellator and he was taking pictures with Scott Coker. You know, GSP said he would fight Conor for $10 million, and I think he would if they offered him $10 million. Call the UFC crazy, but I think GSP would take that payday, but first you have to look at how does GSP do against Michael Bisping. I don't think, I mean, is GSP just going to be like a going from super fight to super fight? You know, what's going on here? If he wins against Michael Bisping, he's contractually obligated to fight Robert Whittaker. If he loses, then maybe that opens up negotiations against Conor, but do you really want a GSP who just lost to Michael Bisping to have his next fight against be a much smaller Conor, you know?
Yes.
I think it's a strange scenario because I never thought I'd be talking about this, you know, after GSP said he wants to fight Conor a year ago. Now everyone wants these super fights, and GSP has this super fight, so I just want to see what happens with this fight first. I want to see him focus on Michael Bisping. If he wins, I want to see him fight Robert Whittaker. If he loses, then let's take it from there. What's the next step for GSP's career? Maybe it's more super fights. Maybe he fights Conor. I don't know, but I really think that we should wait to see what happens in a few weeks. I mean, God, it's only 3 weeks away. So I prefer to just sit, wait, and see where the cards fall, see how GSP performs, see what happens there, and then maybe they should talk about what's the next step.
So if GSP were to win this 185-pound title, I absolutely refuse to believe that he would not want to go out there and find the biggest fight he could possibly be in for the most money possible. And there's no other person than Conor McGregor to make the most money in the UFC. And if you recall, back at UFC 196, when Conor McGregor fought Nate Diaz for the first time, GSP was in attendance. He was in, you know, first row. He was in the first row seat watching the fight. And that's not something that GSP does ever. He doesn't attend fights very often. And I think the motivation there was for him to, you know, basically want to come out of retirement. You know, I think he was hoping for Conor McGregor to win and continue his rise to superstardom, and then call out Conor McGregor and have a, you know, a super fight of all super fights between GSP and Conor McGregor. Unfortunately for GSP, Nate Diaz had, you know, other plans in mind, and he beat Conor McGregor. But I don't believe at all that GSP would not be interested in a Conor McGregor fight. He has said before he made his return that he would be willing to go as low as 155. Because he's not, you know, the most, you know, the biggest 170 pounder in the world either. I think he says he can cut to 155. So I don't see it out of the realm of possibility that GSP could, you know, win the 185 pound title and then possibly even meet Conor McGregor halfway at 170 or possibly even drop to 155 to challenge for that title. So I think GSP is a very smart man, and I think he's looking for, you know, the most money possible in the twilight of his career. So if the opportunity for Conor McGregor is there, I don't think he would pass it up. I think, you know, maybe he's just kind of wanting the attention to be on the Michael Bisping fight for the moment. I think GSP is very apprehensive about talking about future opponents when he already has an opponent in mind. So I think at this point he really just wants to concentrate on Michael Bisping, but I don't buy for a second that he would not be interested in a Conor McGregor fight if that were to be a possibility for him.
Leo want to steal my damn conspiracy theory line, so I had to think of something else that I was going to spit out there. But I do agree. I think this is just a ploy by GSP to try to make sure that when the UFC does come to him with an offer for Conor McGregor, unless, like David pointed out, unless he gets smoked and derailed, I mean, in a brutal fashion by Michael Bisping, even if he loses, I think if GSP is competitive, I do think that he may stick around just for a super fight. I don't think he'll try to do a contender fight with Yoel Romero or Luke Rockhold. I think he would just stick around knowing that, okay, I can, you know, I can still compete at the high level for one reason or another, you know, however it may finish. Bisping was just a better man tonight. Or as GSP would say, we are the fight, but tonight you are the better man tonight. But it will be something to see Conor McGregor and George St. Pierre. We're talking about the former pay-per-view king against the current pay-per-view king, Canada, Ireland, two very different fighting styles, but it will be a tremendous showdown to see how it is. And I'll be honest, I know contractually if he beats Michael Bisping, He is supposed to fight Robert Whittaker with the knee injury. There's only three fights I want to see George St. Pierre have. The Michael Bisping one, okay, sure. But I want to see him fight Anderson Silva, and I want to see him fight Conor McGregor. So even if he loses, again, unless he gets smoked and derailed within a minute or two and just looks completely old and doesn't have it anymore, I think the UFC needs to come to him and say, look, we couldn't get it done before. Let's work out something to where you fight either Silva or McGregor, or hopefully both of them in the future, so we can make these big-time super fight cards happen. He's still at a relatively young age to where, you know, he'll be, what, 35, I think, by the time they fight. So he's still at an age where, you know, it's not necessarily so much wear and tear, plus he's been gone for a minute. So I would love to see this fight happen. I think if it did happen, it will probably be the biggest event in MMA history if you were able to get Conor McGregor, George St. Pierre against each other. Will that fight take place in the future? Time will tell us. I want to ask you guys this as we wrap up the show here, and this is a more serious issue, and we've talked about this on the show before, but this past weekend I saw one of the most disturbing images I've ever seen in the sport of mixed martial arts. Over in Japan, there's a promotion called Pancrase, and, you know, it's not like how it was in the 90s with Ken Shamrock, Frank Shamrock, and Boss Rudin there, but they're trying to make a comeback. They had one of their fighters making weight. I believe his name is Douglas Lima, not the one from Bellator, but he was so...
It's a common name, huh?
It is a very common name, just like Silva and the nickname Pitbull. It's everywhere. But he did such a bad weight cut and was so dehydrated, he could not walk up to the scale and stand under his own power. Gentlemen, we have seen plenty of fighters who the day of weigh-ins, maybe they need some help walking in the back. Maybe when they're getting up out the seat, someone reaches the arm out and helps them up. We've seen that before. I've never seen somebody needed to be damn near carried to the stage, up the stairs, up to the scale, and almost held on the scale from tipping over. I think the only time they took his hand off was like for 3 seconds so that they could get the official weight and then held off as well, and he was still allowed to fight. Now, he did lose. He was on a winning streak, I believe, a nine-fight win streak, but that was lost, obviously. Guys, what do you make of hearing horror stories like this? And again, what's up with MMA, especially the UFC? This didn't happen in the UFC, but what's up with MMA not having more weight classes? Leo, I'll start with you.
Yeah, so this conversation comes up a lot when people ask me, why do you like MMA? It's such a barbaric sport. And, you know, often I'll tell them, you know, it's a very controlled setting. You know, it's just martial arts. You know, both guys are, you know, very well trained. And very rarely do we see anything brutal, like, you know, a brutal knockout or anything like that. But I think the most barbaric aspect of our sport is the weight cutting. And I think this horrible video really showcases that. And you know, to some degree, I'm kind of glad that this kind of, you know, became a big public issue, because it's going to force, debates to go on and see how we can fix these weight cutting issues. I think the video was just really hard to watch. And I think we've seen, you know, other cases such as, Chris Cyborg just crying her heart out, you know, trying to cut weight, and she was in so much pain. And, this poor guy, I think his name is Daniel Lima. He had to basically be dragged onto the stage, and he couldn't even keep his balance on the weight on the scale. So it was an absolute horrible thing to watch. But I think it's a very important thing that we had to watch, because it's going to start these debates going. Hopefully, you know, maybe adding new weight classes is not the answer, but at least it's a step in the right direction. And maybe this no cutting more than 10% of your body weight is not the answer, but it's a step in the right direction. And I think, the California State Athletic Commission is one of the leading commissions in the U.S. And I think they're one of the leading fronts in this issue. So I really hate to see, these guys put themselves through this, you know, try to gain a competitive advantage by being the bigger guy on the cage, but really sacrificing their bodies. And, you know, we've seen what weight cutting has done to guys like Johnny Hendricks. You know, it's basically ruined their careers, and they still keep trying to do it over and over and over again. But this is certainly an issue that needs to be addressed. I want to see weight cutting basically eradicated from combat sports, and especially in MMA, because, these guys are taking, you know, heavy headshots to their brains, and their brains have really not recovered in time for this kind of punishment. So hopefully, you know, the debates will get started, and some, you know, some of these issues will start to get, you know, eradicated from MMA.
Yeah, this is a problem that we're just going to keep hearing about, and we've been talking about the weight cutting issue for so long now, and it's absolutely shocking to me. It's appalling that we're still talking about this. Nothing's been done, and you know, promotions like the UFC, Bellator, Pancrase, they still allow these fighters to go out, do these huge weight cuts, and they don't do anything about it. I mean, when Kevin Lee said the other day, what did he say, he had to cut 19 pounds? He still has to cut 19 pounds in a day. Well, the night before the fight, he said that. And I think it's ridiculous that you still have to do this. But I think it's even more ridiculous that they're just not doing anything about it at the same time. I mean, you're just allowing these fighters to go out, put their bodies on the line in the octagon, but it's even harder for them to put their bodies on the line outside of the octagon. The weight cutting aspect is perhaps what you hear most horror stories from is weight cutting rather than what's actually happening inside the cage. And that shouldn't be that way. The weight cutting is something that it's something that's meant to make it a fair fight. Two people going at it in the same weight class, it's not supposed to cause so much physical harm to your body. I remember when they got rid of IVs a few years ago, and when Aldo said, you know, they could get rid of it, but I'm still going to use it against when I fight Conor. What are they going to do, stop me from fighting? I mean, I feel like there's so many things that they could do. I'm not a doctor or anything, but I feel like there's got to be something that they could do to just make this whole process safer and easier. And if that's add a new weight class, I mean, Kevin Lee called for 165-pound weight class, as have others. If it's creating a new weight class, then if it's for the health and the fighter's well-being, then that should happen. Dana White is strongly opposed to creating new divisions, but I don't think it's – I think you got to worry about fighter safety and health, and it's kind of crazy when the UFC will pull Mark Hunt out of a fight when they're worried about him, but they allow Kevin Lee for example, to cut so much weight and go out there with a staph infection and fight, you know, and lose. So I think I feel like this is a problem that's only going to grow worse. And I feel like it's NASCAR where, you know, NASCAR, they don't do anything until someone dies. I mean, they know these problems, but you see a NASCAR race, the racer dies, and then they finally do something about it. And I don't want to see that have to be the case in a sport that I care about so much. I don't want to see that happen in a sport that I really care about. And I think there's got to be something they could do, and fast.
Unfortunately, we have seen fighters in boxing and even in MMA on the smaller circuits lose their lives in the cage and in the ring. So, yeah, the precedent is already there. So if you're waiting for it to happen on the big stage, shame on you. And like Leo said, fighters are always going to find ways to get an advantage. Always the bigger, trying to get as small as you can so you can have that size advantage. And how do you neglect that? Do you put in a percentage of body weight that you can't cut past? Hey, you can't go past this. More weight classes, possibly maybe weighing them every 2 weeks to see where they're at and say, okay, you have to be within X amount of pounds of this weight class this far out before you can. If you're fighting at 170, then you can't be no more than 15 pounds 2 weeks before the fight, you know, between 15 and 20 pounds 2 weeks before the fight. That, you know, maybe something like that, I don't know. But, yes, when Kevin Lee said he had to cut 19 pounds, and this was on Thursday, you're like, what? Say what? 19? Not 9? That's crazy. And the fact that they're fighting at 155, Kevin Lee weighed in at 184 the night of the fight. He said in the press conference, he's about 184. to me, I think that's also unfair that you're fighting 30 pounds above the weight class that you're fighting for a title in. This was to be the best at 155, not the best at who weighed in at 55, and then you blew it up to a middleweight the night of the fight. So, and to have the fighter, Daniel Lima, as Leo corrected me, step on there, shame on the fighter, shame on his coaches, his team, that promotion, and that athletic commission. In fact, I don't even know if there is one over there, okay? That might just be three guys in the back of a damn laundry mat, not to be racist, just sitting back there saying, yeah, put him in a fight. So it's very unfortunate to see that type of shenanigans going on, and I really do hope that the sport itself does incorporate some type of technique, whether it's weight classes or programs. I know Dana White's so against it because he doesn't want it to be like boxing where there's so many champions, but see, that's different because in boxing, there's four or five champions in one weight class. We're just talking about, no. Just add the extra weight class, and there's only the champion in that weight class. That's not the same realm of boxing right there. And I think 65 probably would be the best class to do it in because there's so many guys between 170 and 155. I think that it should be 165 and 195 are the two weight classes you add because those are the two biggest jumps in weight. But we'll see how it goes from there going forward. Hopefully something comes about. On a lighter note here to end the show, rather, I don't know if you guys know this, but on October 11, 1997, in Japan, a promotion started called Pride Fighting Championship. It said, hey, we're going to be a revolutionized. We are going to be the Asian market for mixed martial arts, and we're going to put on fun, exciting, some of the best mixed martial arts you've ever seen. And granted, they damn near did that for as long as they lasted. They gave us some of the best fighters, guys like Fedor Emelianenko, Wanderlei Silva, Rampage Jackson, Sakuraba, and many, many, many more. It gave us some of the greatest finishes and matches in match. We're talking about Wanderlei Silva's knockout of Sakuraba, Rampage power jump over Ricardo Arona, Nogueira with the right hand over, take your pick. And you can't forget about Mirko Krokop, right leg to the hospital, left leg to the morgue. So I ask you guys, in 20 years later, after Pride FC came and unfortunately now has gone, just what are some thoughts, memories, things that you enjoyed, maybe didn't enjoy so much about Pride FC? What are some of the memories you can have of that once famed promotion from across the sun? Leo, I'll start with you.
And I think this touches the heartstrings of every single hardcore MMA fan out there. I think everybody remembers Pride with just such a warmness in their heart. And, you know, we have that Pride never die mentality. And I think, you know, some of my favorite memories of Pride were just really the production values that the Japanese market had to offer. It was such a different product than what we had in the UFC. You know, we had the screaming Pride lady, we had the stage, and we had, you know, the fighters being introduced before the fights. So just the all around package. I loved the 10-minute first rounds, and then the 5-minute second round, and the fight was just judged on a whole instead of, you know, round by round, and, you know, the 10-9 system. You know, we had the yellow cards. Everything about Pride was just so fantastic, and I think there's a lot of things that the UFC can bring from Pride into the UFC, especially the yellow card system. You know, instead of, you know, deducting points, then, you know, kind of install a yellow card system and kind of, you know, start docking percentages from fighters' purses. You know, I think that's a real deterrent for fouls happening in fights. So, you know, obviously the Pride gloves, we've been talking about the Pride gloves, they're more efficient. We don't see as many eye pokes in Pride as we did in the UFC. So, man, take your pick. Everything about Pride was just absolutely amazing. I wish it was still around, but unfortunately, you know, that's no longer the case. But always warm memories from Pride. So happy to celebrate the Pride's 20th birthday.
Yeah, really quick. I know I don't have much time left, but I really miss Pride. Pride was something when it was still there. I didn't really appreciate it, but as the years have gone on, I remember the soccer kicks. You know, I remember seeing all these guys. I remember seeing the middleweight matchups. I mean, come on, like you could see a smaller guy against such a bigger guy. You know, I miss Pride. I definitely appreciate it a lot more 10 years after it's gone. But you know, Pride, so many great memories, and it's one of a kind, and it's good that way that it's in my memory in such a special place. So I really miss Pride, and it was fantastic. So many good things I wish I had more time to talk about it, but Pride was amazing, and it'll always have a special place in my heart.
Now, it truly was something special. It has the longest recorded mixed martial arts fight ever between Royce Gracie and Sakuraba, 90 minutes. Probably would have went longer if not for Gracie's injury to his hip and leg area. It truly was something to marvel at. I mean, I almost want to say it was borderline something out of a comic book. It was a mix of pro wrestling meets a reality TV, mixed martial arts, and it gave us some very fond memories. Again, some of the best fighters and fights of all time. At that time when it was around, his heavyweight division was much better than the UFC's heavyweight division at the time, and some of the fighters were able to come over to the UFC, like Overeem, excuse me, Nogueira, Krokop, Rampage, Henderson. Granted, all of them didn't have the same success. Shogun, not all of them had the same success, but we saw a lot of great moments there from Pride, and it gave us something at the time, which was competition for the UFC, which really we've been missing in the sport of mixed martial arts for a long time. Bellator is trying to do that now, but 20 years later, just want to say to everyone involved with Pride FC, for all the fans out there that did watch it and enjoy it, thank you so much for giving us the memories. And good thing is that even though it's not around, the UFC does have it to where you can go on UFC Fight Pass and enjoy their fights. Guys, that was a hell of a show. Thank you guys so much for coming on. Look forward to talking to you guys again in the future about sports. David, I know you got to go, so I'm going to start with you. Give us any final thoughts you may have before we let you go.
Yeah, I mean, really great weekend of fights. Again, Pride, so many great things to say about that. But, yeah, I mean, it was great. Another great show. Can't wait for next week. Not a lot going on this weekend in terms of fights, but I know we got a fight next week, and Machida's coming back in a couple weeks. Gegard Mousasi's fighting next week, too, in Bellator. So we got an interesting next few weeks, but not this weekend. But, yeah, some interesting stuff to talk about next week.
Indeed, and look forward to talking to it with you guys. David, take care, brother. Until next time, man. Peace. Leo, once again, great show as always, man. You and David always bring the good facts in, always bring the good stuff. Why don't you go ahead and give people your final thoughts before you cut out, my man?
Yeah, as David said, not a whole lot of action going on this coming week, but I do want to give a shout-out to EBI. I believe it's EBI 13 coming up on October 22nd. It's going to be the lightweights. Gary Tonin is going to be competing, a few guys from here in Las Vegas. And then later, a few weeks later in November, it's going to be Combat Jiu-Jitsu, the inaugural Combat Jiu-Jitsu tournament that's going to be starting also by the same makers of EBI. So look out for that. And as always, man, great show, and thanks for having us.
Hey, man, anytime, man. Thank you guys for coming on and providing me with the great context to speak the sports with you guys. It's just like when we go out to watch the fights. So now we're doing it online for the masses to hear. So next time, Leo, man, have a good week and weekend, and I'll talk to you next week. Peace.
Later.
Well, everybody, thank you guys for tuning in. Again, this is Inside the Octagon. You guys can listen to this show every Wednesday between 4 and 5:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time right here on blogtalkradio.com. Be sure to follow me on Twitter at KLUA11, that's KLUA11, and also my sports page on Facebook. That is All Things Sports on Facebook, All Things. My final thought is, with Pride FC and its 20-year anniversary, you know, it shows you that the UFC obviously is the big one. It is the mecca. It is the NFL, but it's not the end all be all of mixed martial arts. If there are other promotions out there that are trying to give us the great content, trying to give us the great matchups, right now Bellator is that main one, but there is plenty of great fighters out there. So I would just recommend for any of you out there that may have a local fight promotion putting on fights, go there and support them. Go there and see what they're putting on. They may not reach the level of Pride, Bellator, and the UFC, but you never know. Hey, all these fighters got to come from somewhere. You yourself might be witnessing the next Ronda Rousey, the next Jon Jones, the next Conor McGregor, the next George St. Pierre, the next Anderson Silva. You never know unless you go there and watch the fight. Till next week, everybody, you guys be safe. Enjoy the week and the weekend. Talk to you next time. Peace.
Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team fucking here. Started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team here. Nigga, started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now my whole team in. Nigga, started from the bottom, now we here. Started from the bottom, now the whole team fucking here. I done kept it real from the jump. Living at my mama's house, we'd argue every month, nigga. I was trying to get it on my own. Working all night, traffic on the